What I had started to realize when I was growing my cells and culture is that when I put the cultures in an unhealthy environment, the cells in those petri dishes started to get sick, they started to die, and they just were doing very, very poorly. However, if I took the same petri dish, moved it from an unhealthy environment, and put it into a healthy environment, the cells would restore their vigor and thrive and grow and develop and differentiate and do all the things they were supposed to do. And so it really revealed, just as Irv had told me in my first day of growing cells in culture, he said, when the cells aren't doing right, first look at the conditions of the environment before trying to change the cells. And I started to see that this was a truth about my cells. And what then became real interesting is when we look at ourselves as individuals, we appear to be single individuals, but we're really comprised of 50 trillion cells or so as a community. And where my work in the laboratory and where our experiences in life merge is this, is that just think of it this way. You are a petri dish, a skin-covered petri dish with 50 trillion cells in it. If you move your petri dish in a healthy environment, they'll grow, they'll thrive, and they'll do everything wonderfully. But if you take that same petri dish and move it into an unhealthy environment, that's when it will start to manifest illness and disease, and its functions will be impaired. So basically, what I started to realize is we left out the vision of the role of the environment in the experiments that we study because we really base this on genes. And in my graduate training, I also recall experiments from over 100 years ago that actually completely deny this reality of genes. And these experiments were with the early scientists, the cell scientists, who were studying marine organisms like starfish and sea urchins. They were working with their egg cells, which were large enough to manipulate. And since the nucleus, the structure inside the cell that contains the genes, is one of the largest structures in a cell, it was the object of a lot of study. And one of the things they did in these early studies was they put a micropipette, a little tiny pipette, puncture the egg cell and suck out the nucleus with all the genes. And in these experiments, what frequently would happen is when the nucleus got pulled out, this egg cell would begin to divide. And some of these enucleated cells, geneless cells, would form embryos of up to 40 to 60 cells before they stopped developing. In other cells, they found that they could remove the nucleus with all the genes and the cells would live, some of them for 2 or more months with no genes in it. So over 100 years ago, there were already experiments that revealed if you remove the genes from the cell still expressed its behavior and adapted to its environment. And why this was important is these experiments really question the fundamental nature that we are teaching in schools and medical school that genes control life. Because basically you have to say this, if you remove the genes from a cell by removing the nucleus, a process called enucleation, and it's done quite a lot today in all kinds of experiments with genetic engineering, they take the genes out of a cell. What's important about it is this, if the cell still lives, and it doesn't have the genes in it, and it's still expressing control, then the real important question is, well, what controls the cells? Obviously not the genes, because the genes are not even in there. Well, I did the same kind of experiments myself in my clone cultures. I used different processes. For example, I'd irradiate my cells with gamma rays. These are radiation waves that destroy DNA. And so my cells in these cultures were living, but their DNA was all destroyed. And guess what? They moved around, they ate, they breathe, they digest their food, they communicate with other cells, they avoid toxins. Basically, their lives are completely unperturbed at that point, and yet they don't have any genes in them. And so all of a sudden, we go back to the nature of the central dogma that life is controlled by genes and say, you can't explain the results of these experiments. As I said, most of my colleagues wanted to look at my experiments as exceptions, but the reality is there can be no exceptions to the rule. If you say genes control life and you remove the genes and control still exists, then obviously it's time to look for something else other than what the genes are. What is it that's controlling life? Well, actually, we can even ask a better question. If we thought the genes were controlling life and we take the genes and the nucleus is the organelle that contains the genes, out of the cell, and the cell still lives, the question is, well, what was the function of the nucleus then? Because we took that structure out and the cell's still going. And here's what the answer is. When you take the nucleus out, you remove all the blueprints to make the protein parts. So a cell will survive until some proteins that might be necessary to keep the cell alive, because the proteins are the mechanistic part of the cell. If I lose some of the proteins that are vital to the cell's function, and I don't have the nucleus in the cell, then that means I cannot replace those proteins because the blueprints are gone. That's when the cell will start to get sick and die. So the point about it is this. Removing the nucleus in the genes does what? It prevents the cells from replacing its parts. It also prevents the cells from reproducing itself. So all of a sudden I say, well, wait, all the years we've been talking about the genes and the nucleus containing the genes as the elements that control life, when in fact that's not really what the function of those organelles are. That the genes are reproduction. That their function is reproducing parts and reproducing the cell. And I joke about it in my lectures because I talk about science being a male-dominated profession and that old joke about, of course, what do males think with. And so by doing that, the male scientist created the gonad of the cell, the nucleus, to be its brain, when in fact its function is reproduction. The genes don't know what is needed by the cell, what they should do next. There is no self-actualization in a gene. A gene is not an intelligent unit. And yet, think about all the things you've heard and read, that a gene turns on and a gene controls things, that you're walking down the street and a gene is going to turn on and give you cancer, that we talk about genes as these active, intelligent elements, when in fact, genes are blueprints, strictly blueprints. And why is this relevant? Because our terminology describing the role and action of genes is based on as if they're self-actualizing intelligent beings. A gene turns on. Well, think about it this way. As a blueprint, consider this. Consider you're in an architect's office, and you're looking over this architect's shoulder, and they're working on a blueprint, and then you happen to casually ask the architect, is that blueprint on or off? And of course, he's going to look at you with a very confused look, thinking, what do you mean on or off? It's a blueprint. It has neither on nor off. What's interesting about it is DNA is a blueprint. And while we talk about a gene being turned on and being turned off, there is no on and off. A blueprint is a blueprint. If blueprints were self-actualizing, then think about it this way. That architect could take the blueprints he's drawing up, drive by a building site, throw the blueprints into the property, and come back a month later and find the building done. But the reality is, no, blueprints are not self-actualizing controlling devices. What you have is a blueprint, but then you have a contractor who reads the blueprints and assembles the building. What the Human Genome Project revealed was, the genes are the blueprints, but we didn't understand the nature of the architect. What is the architect? Who is the architect that takes the genes and turns it back into life? Well, this is where my research on clone cells starts to come into play here. Because it said that the fate of the cells, their architectural appearance, their structure, is really determined by the environment. So the question is, how does environmental information lead to the activation and control of genes? Well, this is where I started to realize that I had trouble staying in my conventional academic position, because as I started to really go into the question of looking for what controls life, and this was before the Human Genome Project came out. In fact, I left the university in 1980, 7 years before the Human Genome Project was started, because I already was aware that genes didn't control life. I was already aware that I could remove the genes from the cell and still have the control. I was aware that the environment was influential, but then my colleagues looked at me as not just being a radical, but a heretic. I was actually called a heretic. And for me, that was like a confusing moment, because I'm thinking, I'm in science. How can there be a concept of a heretic in science? And then it finally dawned on me when I read the description of the word dogma, because the fundamental belief that we were operating from, DNA goes to RNA goes to protein, called the central dogma, is what I was teaching. When I finally decided to read the definition of dogma, I was shocked. Because the definition of dogma was a truth based on religious persuasion and not scientific fact. And all of a sudden I said, oh my God, all the years I've been teaching in medical school, I've been teaching religion, teaching the fact that genes control life, even calling it the dogma. And of course, now that I decided that from my experiments that genes weren't controlling the life, I was a heretic because I was conflicting with the dogma. And this became a whole religious argument. At some point, the religiosity of where I was led me to resign my position. And it was interesting because when I resigned my position and being outside of the confines of academic belief with its blinders to focus on what is the conventional belief of the time, I had great opportunities to expand my horizons. That's when I started to read into the physics and get information about the mechanics of life. That's when I started to advance into understanding about brain function and neuroscience, because what I was really trying to find out is, where's the brain of the cell? Because here's a simple fact. If you take an organism and remove its brain, by definition, you take that brain and throw it away, that organism is going to die, because the function of the brain is to coordinate and integrate all the activities of the living organism to keep it alive. So an organism without a brain is dead. Well, here's the point. We've been teaching, and I've been teaching personally, that the nucleus with all its genes was the brain of the cell. And yet the reality is, in my enucleation experiments, is the equivalent of taking the brain out and throwing it away. And yet when I did that, it didn't change the behavior of the cells. They still survived. They only died later when they weren't able to reproduce the parts. So basically, these kind of experiments completely deny the concept that the cell is controlled by the genes. And in fact, as we talked about, the genes were really the gonad function of the cell, not the brain of the cell. So there I am, outside of the convention, and beginning an opportunity to study, well, where is the brain of the cell? What is it that controls life? Well, I've been working with, up to this time, human cells and cells from birds and from other mammals such as mice and rats. And these cells are very complex cells in evolution, in the sense that these higher forms of animal cells are the kinds of cells with lots of things in their cytoplasm, like the nucleus we talked about, organelles like mitochondria, other organelles that have weird names like endoplasmic reticulum and Golgi. The cell is filled up with a lot of organelles. Interesting point, organelles mean diminutive organs. And so it's interesting because for every organ that we have in the human body that carries out a function, there's an organelle in the cell, meaning small organ, that carries out the same functions. Well, my pursuit is, well, which of these organelles is serving as the brain, realizing that the nucleus can be removed and the cell still is alive? I started to realize that working with these higher forms of cells was still very difficult because of the large number of different inclusions of organelles of different types that are found in the cell. I went back to a more primitive cell, to a bacterium. A bacterial cell doesn't have organelles in it. It doesn't have a nucleus. It doesn't have mitochondria. It doesn't have any real structure. Bacterial cells are just a little membrane-bound piece of cytoplasm. And the significance about it is, despite its simplicity and its structure, just an organized membrane surrounding a droplet of cytoplasmic components, these bacteria have very complex lives. They have digestive systems, respiratory systems, excretory systems. They have reproductive systems. They even have nervous systems. Bacteria read the environment and respond to the environment by changing their behavior and changing their functions. By that definition, something in that little miniature cell with hardly anything in it except a membrane and a drop of cytoplasm, something is controlling all of these functions. Somewhere there's a digestive system, a respiratory, excretory, and a brain. And what my research really revealed was simply this. Well, there was only two components to observe in the bacterium, the membrane and the cytoplasm. The cytoplasm didn't have any organelles. It was just like a solution of proteins and building blocks and energy supply and some aids for reproducing some of the parts. So all of a sudden I said, well, wait, but where's the digestive system coming from? Where's the respiratory system coming from? Where's the brain? And the only structure left was the membrane, the skin of the cell. Well, an interesting understanding in the kind of biology I was involved with, where I was studying the structure and biochemistry of organisms, is What we realize in conventional biology is that the structure of a system implies what the function is. And the function requires a structure, so structure and function are intimately tied together. And there's been a consistent understanding, the more complex a structure, the more complex the function. When it comes to the cell membrane, this is where it got very interesting, because the cell membrane is so thin a skin that you can't even see it with a regular microscope. It really requires an electron microscope to see this thing, because it's only angstroms thick, and angstroms are the units of length between two carbon atoms. So if you have a chemical compound with two carbon atoms, an angstrom is the distance between two carbon atoms. And what the membrane was about 700 angstroms thick. And that, so it wasn't even visible with a light microscope. And when the electron microscope was developed, then it was found that every living organism on this planet, all of them, have a cell membrane. In regard to the other components like mitochondria, nucleus, Golgi, they're variable from one organism to another organism, but there's one uniform organelle, the cell membrane. It has the same basic structure in a bacterium as it has in a human cell. It is essentially the first organelle to evolve, and is required for all living things. Yet, when regard to structure and function, when you looked at this organelle, it looked like a little tiny piece of plastic wrap, like saran wrap, that surrounded the cytoplasm. And so, for the longest time, biologists assumed that this little tiny nondescript membrane was nothing more than just an envelope to contain the cytoplasm. So it represented a skin, a barrier, but apparently it must have had holes in it, because food can get in and waste matter can get out of the cell, so the membrane must have some kind of way of getting things in and out. So they proceed to the membrane as this little tiny plastic wrap with holes in it. And that was all they attributed to the function of the cell membrane. And yet when I started to look at it, I started to say, wait a minute, this cell membrane, this is the structure that is doing digestion. It's the thing that's doing respiration. It's doing excretion, and it's obviously working in the neural system in these little primitive bacteria. And so my research started to focus on the cell membrane as an information processor. And I started to study the molecular nature of this membrane and how it could respond to environmental information and how it could lead to changing the function of the cell. It was interesting, because I resigned my position at the University of Wisconsin and just walked out one day after realizing that I felt out of integrity teaching basic science to medical students and giving them the belief that genes control life, when clearly the results from my experiments did not support that. On my departure, I had the opportunity, as I said, to be unfettered in my research, and I started to read into various other fields to try to get an integration of information about how these cells are working. It was fun, because about 3 years later, I came back to Madison because my daughter was graduating from school. And while back in Madison, I thought, well, geez, maybe I could go back and talk to my old colleagues about this new understanding I was creating about the nature of the cell membrane and how the membrane is really what processes information and controls life. And so I asked my friend who was chairman at the time, I said, listen, I'm back in town. How about letting me give a lunchtime seminar about my new story called The Membrane as an Information Processor? Well, he said, sure, come on in and give this lecture. Wednesday lectures were conventionally just a social meeting where a lot of the faculty and the students would come together on Wednesday, bring their lunch, hang out, and then somebody would give a talk, and people would pay attention or not, whatever, you know, what was going on. It was, again, just more of a social thing, and a person could give a talk and stutter and drool, and at the end, everybody would applaud and say, oh, that was wonderful. And so I figure, okay, I got an opportunity to do a Wednesday lunchtime lecture, so I show up. And I see all of my former colleagues and a lot of the students that I didn't know were there and other people I knew. And I start to give this lecture on the information processor or the membrane, and talking about how genes really didn't control life. And as I was giving this lecture, about like midway through the lecture, all of a sudden it dawned on me as I was talking, I realized nobody was eating anything. They were just sitting there staring at me with like big saucer eyes. And finally I get to the conclusion and I say, thank you very much for listening. And as soon as I say that, I pause and there was dead silence. Not a person made a sound. They were all just sitting there, frozen in their seats. Nobody had eaten lunch. Nobody had talked to each other. And that was that hardest silence I ever heard in my life. I was just waiting for something to happen. And all of a sudden, one person way in the back of the room started to clap. And as soon as that person clapped, everybody stared at that person. He stopped clapping. And then the next thing I realized, they all got up like it was a ceremony and they walked out on me. Every one of my colleagues walked out on me, and I felt so like, oh my God, am I that weird? Am I that crazy? It's sort of like when a soldier has done something wrong and they take him out of the army, they take his epaulets off and strip him of his buttons from his uniform and, you know, force him to walk away. And here I was being invalidated, my lab coat buttons essentially being stripped from me, saying, you know, you're a heretic. This is unbelievable stuff, and sent me on my way. I was completely devastated by this because I thought this was just great science about how the membrane is really controlling life. So the interesting thing is, I said, okay, I might be crazy, but I started looking at the literature, and the more I looked at the literature, everything kept revealing the same thing, is that I was on this right track. So I continued this research, and I'm working on my own, and now I actually end up with a job. I'm teaching in the Caribbean on an island, Grenada, one of what we call offshore medical schools, where students that can't get into conventional schools, medical schools in the United States, have an opportunity. There are several schools that are found outside the United States where students can go in and do the work and then come back in and take the required board exams in the United States. And I was teaching at one of these schools. And while I was teaching there, I had continued my research on understanding the nature of the cell membrane. And it was on a particular night in 1985 that it was about 2 a.m. in the morning, and it's now about 10 years of research on trying to understand the nature of the cell membrane and how this structure is involved with controlling the cell. I've looked at it upside down, left and right, backwards, forwards, revealed its structure and through all the kinds of molecular analyses, studied all the movements, and I had an understanding of it, but it really didn't gel until this particular night in 1985. And in 1985, I rewrote the definition of the cell membrane as I'd been looking at it in terms of biochemistry. I had rewritten the definition in a way that I had never written it before. And I wrote down this following definition of the cell membrane. The cell membrane is a liquid crystal semiconductor with gates and channels. And I heard myself say that, and as I was typing it on the computer, it really dawned on me and said, wow, that's a real interesting definition. It's funny because I've heard that definition somewhere, but not in terms of biology. And then I started getting like, oh, somewhere, I just read that. And I looked around, and there on my desk, on the corner of my desk, was my first Macintosh with this little smiley face and a book right next to it called Understanding Your Microprocessor. And this was a booklet that I bought from Radio Shack describing in simple terms how my computer worked, because that was my first computer. And all of a sudden I grabbed that book and thumbed through it, and there it was on page 3 in the introduction. There was the definition of a computer chip, which read, a computer chip is a crystal semiconductor with gates and channels. And I stopped for a second and said, oh my God, wow, what a coincidence. The definition of the cell membrane and the definition of the computer chip are exactly the same. And then all of a sudden, I started to realize that the data in my head started to spin around like crazy. And it was interesting because I got this visual image of like a slot machine at Las Vegas where you pull the crank and then all those little wheels start spinning. And then all of a sudden a cherry shows up and another cherry shows up and another. And all of a sudden all these cherries came across the screen of my mind. And it was like this jackpot, because what all of a sudden I understand was it was not a coincidence that the cell membrane is structurally and functionally homologous, meaning the same as a computer chip, that its function is exactly the same as a silicon-based computer, but this is a carbon-based computer. I started to realize that the cell was a chip and that the nucleus was a hard disk with programs. The genes were programs. But what was really exciting, as I was typing this on my computer, I realized at that particular moment, my computer was like a cell. It had programs built into it. But what was expressed by the computer wasn't determined by the programs. It was determined by the information that I, as the environment, was typing onto the keyboard. And all of a sudden, all the pieces fell into place. And I realized, oh my God, the cell membrane is actually an information processing computer chip. The cell's genes are the hard drive with all the potentials, and that's why every cell, such as a stem cell in your body, can form any kind of cell, because every nucleus has all the genes that make up a human. But why should a cell be skin, and one cell be bone, and one cell be eye? And the answer is, not because of the gene programs, but because of the feedback of the information from the environment. And all of a sudden, the bigger thing hit me, and the bigger thing was this, that what makes us different from each other is the character of the keyboard on the surface of our cells. That, as we're going to get into later on and describe how this works, that the keyboard has a pin key, a pin that makes each one of us different. And the significance about it is that the pin key, the identity keys on the surface of our cells, respond to environmental information. And all of a sudden, the biggest aha that I could ever imagine hit me at that moment. And that was this, that my identity is actually an environmental signal that is playing through the keyboard on the surface of my cell and engaging my genetic programs. That I myself was not actually even inside the cell. That you are not inside your cell. You're playing through your cell using the keyboard as an interface. That you are an identity from the environment. I was an identity from the environment. Well, what was really profound about this was that when I went back in my history as to why I became a biologist, I became a biologist because in my youth and the dysfunctional developmental experiences that I had in my younger days, I realized that when I wanted to get some kind of truth, that I didn't see that religion was offering that. Because while they spoke all the words and they all sounded really nice, their behaviors in no way seemed to match what they were talking about. That led me to science, and as a youth, I really saw that science was important because a truth is in science is the same in New York as it is in Brazil, as it is in Germany. That all sciences are true, and once we establish facts, they become universal and that they become accepted by all as this is a truth, rather than what I saw religion as separate, each giving different truths and not being coordinated. So I went away from spirit, which I didn't believe in, and ended up in science, only to end up in that particular night in 1985, identifying the fact that my identity was something from the environment playing through my cells. And it was the greatest shock in my world because I was completely thrown from a non-spiritual reality into the requirement of a spiritual reality based on the fact that I was not inside the cell, I was playing through the cell, meaning this, my cell was like a little television set with antennas, and that I was a broadcast, and that my broadcast station was picked up by the antennas, and that controlled the readout of the genes so that I was actually programming my cells. What was relevant was I realized that if the cell died, it didn't necessarily mean the loss of the broadcast, that the broadcast is out there whether the cell was here or not. And all of a sudden this hit me with such profound awe that I actually just had this complete emotional transformation because at 1:59 in the morning, here I was non-spiritual looking at the mechanistic side of life. And at 2 a.m. in the morning, all of a sudden realizing the requirement and existence of an identity that was outside of the cell and independent of the cell. And I was just completely blew my mind. I was so out of it. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I started to realize, for example, the first important thing was a weight was lifted off my shoulder, a weight of mortality. I didn't realize it. None of us really realize it, that our mortality is very principal element in guiding everything we do, because every step you take, your biology is reflecting on whether this step is going to enhance your survival or compromise your survival. What I realized was when survival wasn't that important because I realized my eternal character is part of some broadcast in the field, this weight, this fear of mortality disappeared. And it's been great because that's been about 25 years ago. And it's just one of the most wonderful, liberating experiences I ever had because it took away the nature of mortality. It added more to who I was and more value to what my life was. But this was just so exciting. I really wanted to tell somebody about it. I was living on this piece of beachway off on the edge of Grenada. I didn't have a phone. It was 2 o'clock in the morning and wasn't anybody I was going to call anyway. And I thought, who could I tell? There wasn't anybody there. I just got so excited. And I remember, well, it's a medical school, you know, where I'm teaching that students are up all night. So I got in my car and I drove off to the medical school because I had to tell somebody about this exciting discovery, about this new understanding about how the membrane controls life and the spiritual character. And I drive up to the school and sure enough, the lights are on. I run in the library. I'm sure my hair was all up. My eyes were wide open. I was like, oh, so excited, this great secret of life. And I grabbed the first year student. I said, listen to this. And I started explaining about the nature of the cell membrane and the crystal structure and all the idea about the physics and the Fourier transforms and things that he didn't understand a word I was talking about. And he looked up at me after I took a break and he said, are you okay, Dr. Lipton? He thought I was so wigged out that I might need medical attention at this point. And yet it was so amazing to come across this piece of information and have no one to communicate with. So started off on this whole preamble to get to this point of actually telling you a new biology. And this new biology deals with the fact that the brain of the cell is the skin of the cell. The skin of the cell is called the membrane. And it's interesting because this skin is what separates the inside of the cell from the outside world. And in this particular position, the skin becomes very important because the skin is the interface of two dynamic realms, the interior of the body, the self, and the exterior ever-changing world that we live in. And as in its position, the skin can see both environments at the same time, read the conditions of each environment, and then serve as a device to read what's going on in the outside world and adjust what's going on in the inside world to keep us alive. So the skin of the cell is the brain of the cell, and that is the functional element that controls life. And why this is relevant is because it's a process of dynamic control as compared to the concept that we were dealing with before with genes, where there was a program established at conception and the rest of our lives was just essentially a readout of that program. The membrane, as controlling of genes, offered new insights. The membrane could select genes and deselect genes. The membrane could control genes. So basically, what we're going to talk about from this point on is the nature of how this membrane or brain of the cell works. And the reason why this is important is because when you understand the nature of it, you'll start to realize we are not victims of our genes. That through the action of the membrane, we can actually control our genes and our biology and our life. And we have been doing it all the time, although we've been laboring under the belief that we are victims. And why this science becomes really interesting is because it reveals how the membrane perceives the environmental signals and then translates those signals into biological signals that control our biology. And so that where this really becomes relevant to us is that we perceive the environment and adjust our biology. And as we'll get into a little bit later, we'll recognize a very important fact. Not all of our perceptions are accurate. That we acquire perceptions that are actually misperceptions. The relevance about that is, since the biology converts perceptions into biology, if we are laboring under misperceptions, then those misperceptions adjust our biology, but actually provide for a misadjustment of our biology. So when our perceptions are inaccurate, we can actually destroy our own biology. Then when we turn around and recognize, since perceptions control life, then think about it this way. The old vision of genes controlling life, to change life, we have to change the genes, the Human Genome Project, genetic engineering. But when we understand that genes are just respondents to the environment from the perceptions handled by the membrane, then we can realize that if life isn't going well, then what we really have to do is not change our genes, but change our perceptions. And that's a heck of a lot easier to do than physically messing with the body. And in fact, this is the power of this new biology, that we can control our lives by controlling our perceptions.
This concludes Session 1 of The Wisdom of Your Cells. Our program continues with Session 2, The Assumptions of the Apocalypse.